Very excited to keep delivering such incredible voices, seminal voices. We're excited to have you back, Renette and David. And Sasha, you had a vision to bring on Anna and talk about what so many people have been asking about, which is this conversation around natural law, everything that you reference about being sovereign. And people are sending messages ongoing with us. For those of you that are just tuning in, and one of the things that we're doing with the censorship that's happening is really encouraging everyone to get on everyone's mailing list. If you're not on ours, it's reclaimyourlives.com. We'll put links to all of our guests in the comments as well. And with that, Sasha, I know we're anxious to get this conversation going. I'm going to hand it over to you to introduce Judge Anna to our New Earth audience.
Very good. Thank you, Imani and Dr. David Martin, one of my dearest and longest standing friends. Great to see you. And Raynette, I've seen him, just powerhouse. And my mum loves you, incidentally. I have to pass that on. And just so thrilled for me to introduce Anna von Reitz. I can't help but refer to you in the woken state and the sleep state, Anna, as Judge Anna von Reitz. I've always known you as that. I've never met you formally. But I do regard you as the Alpha and the Omega, and I'm not often shied by people, but I'm very, very happy to be with you and very, very honored to speak with you tonight. So a very warm welcome to you, Anna von Reitz.
Thank you.
I'm going to just give a brief background, more to contextualize for David and Raynette, the gravity that Anna brings to any conversation in point of fact, but the conversation which we are looking to have, which is a very quantum one. So Anna von Reitz is a former postal judge who's been researching American constitutional foundations and functionality for over 40 years. You wouldn't think that looking at you, Anna, but it's true. Your currently realized focus, as I understand it, encompasses the following points here, deftly put together by my dear friend, Ken Burgess. Number one, the history and original seating of the American experiment. Two, the original contracts, treaties, and jurisdictions involved with this experiment, the American experiment. Number three, how these agreements functioned during their time of correct functionality. Number four is how these agreements got subverted during and after the American Civil War. The fifth point is where we are currently within the state of affairs in 2020. The sixth point here, why our current situation has gotten so corrupted as a function of its intrinsic and unrecognized administrative structure. And finally, point seven here, how we can reestablish its correct original structure and allow we the people to regain our rightful and correct position as primary within this chain of authority. I hope that that does justice to your orientation, and welcome to the panel.
Thank you very much. Yes, it does kind of run the gamut for me in terms of the areas of study that our fellowship has engaged in. Where we really connect with you, Sasha, is the entire concept and practice of natural law. And natural law was the foundation of our country. Many people don't realize that. When the founders were talking about nature's God, you may remember that little phrase. They were talking about the law of nature and nature's God. What is actual and factual, not what is airy-fairy in your brain only. And people don't often think about things in terms of whether they're physical and actual, or whether they are something that we have as a concept. The difference between an actual living man and a name, for example. We're not taught to think about that. In fact, our attention is misdirected toward other less important things. And we are sort of glossed over, you know, in our upbringing and our training and our education. We gloss over the fact that there's a difference between a living man and his name. We are taught to just accept the concept of money, you know, without question. Yeah. And I can still remember being a small child and thinking about these things. So I don't know how or why, but maybe I'm just more curious. But anyway, I have always thought about these things. And so bringing forward this conversation, especially with your group, because you're obviously thinking the same, you know, the same track of, you know, making those distinctions and realizing that natural law, by its very nature, overstands anything that we can do with our statutory laws and our regulations and codes, and the things that people more commonly think of as law.
Very good, thank you. And of course, the great preoccupation that most, if not all of us have, is really understanding the distinction between the living and the dead, the masked and the unmasked, the ensouled and the uninsouled, if we could take it to that level. And I think we're getting to that territory when you start to see the kind of weapon systems being deployed in Beirut and Wuhan and elsewhere around the world in the last few days. We're into very, very bizarre territory. And it seems that the subterranean wars are surfacing somewhat, and each man to his own. But we're going into very scary twilight zone waters, and people of the world, not least the intellectual type that we address, but all peoples of the world are going to have to start waking up very, very quickly to the fact that we are a multidimensional peoples, that we are spirit incarnate, and that we are only using a very limited bandwidth of who and what we are. But you, the work you've done, Annas, really helps people, especially very well-educated people, to begin to intellectually understand, define, make that distinction between the living and the dead, between the corporate fiction, the straw man, the trust, the living, the sentient. That's why I think it's so very important. It's easy for radical mavericks and bohemians like me to you know, talk that talk. But when you come and you actually use pure law and the art of reason, it's done tremendous good in this world. Similarly, the work that Dr. David Martin has done for many, many long years, dealing with the most abstract and abstruse subjects and then bringing them in simple terms and simple formulae for people to understand. David, I'm sure you've got questions that you'd want to put to Anna, but I'm very keen to invite you into the only question I'm qualified to ever ask you, David, which is, what is your take on the status quo?
Well, in light of the work Anna has been doing for quite some time, it's I think helpful to put a historical context in the series of events which have led us very much off track. And this precedes certainly 1770s by quite a bit. If we look at one of the most overlooked pieces of jurisprudence in modern humanity, we have been taught, we have been trained, and we've been brainwashed into the observation of King John's Magna Carta in 1215. But we have been willfully misled to not read its companion document, which was called the Charter of the Forest. The Charter of the Forest in modern times, not unlike some of the Hammurabi Code previous, but the Charter of the Forest was the first explicit statement in common law to actually state that humans had an organic right to exist and persist and thrive. It's not surprising that we talk about the Magna Carta because that's the establishment of the lords, you know, fighting with each other over who gets to control the vassals and who gets to control the serfs. But we neglect to look at the Charter of the Forest, which fundamentally makes the argument that life is endowed by its very nature with its capacity to persist and thrive. And the fact that we don't even communicate that there was a Charter of the Forest, right? People hear the Magna Carta, but no one talks about the Charter of the Forest. That was actually the people's declaration that they would not ever cede the right to home, shelter, food, gainful employment, or any of the other liberties affiliated with living. And what I appreciate about Anna's work is that it sets in context the fact that when we get to Tocqueville and we get to, you know, kind of the constitutional questions that come in at the 1780s and 1790s, What we also fail to look at is what happened at the Treaty of Ghent. The majority of humanity, for whatever reason, decides that somehow or another, somewhere between a gunshot in Lexington, Massachusetts, and the ratification of documents in Philadelphia, somehow that was the beginning and end of the start of America. They failed to ever consider the War of 1812, which wasn't actually a War of 1812. It was a war that actually extended for a period of time. But the Treaty of Ghent, which ended that war, set in motion the end of the American experiment before it ever got started. If you look at the root, the last act, and by the way, you know, I'm going to leave it to everybody who loves conspiracies to put this one together. But, you know, at the outbreak of the coronavirus death counts, we kept hearing the number 33 infections. And that was the number that was ubiquitous across the country. But if you go to 1933, the actual reason why 1933 is important, and the reason why 33 is important, is because it was in 1933 that we violated the last of those principles enshrined in the Charter of the Forest. Because in 1933, one of the acts that very few people, I've never heard anybody else talk about it, but I'm a geek, I read the laws and I pay attention to this, the Agriculture Adjustment Act of 1933, which came as part of the Banking Act, part of the Insurance Act, and part of the Securities Act of 1933. But the most damaging one, far more egregious than what happened in finance, was the fact that in 1933, the Agriculture Adjustment Act forced mandatory scarcity. Did you hear what I said? Mandatory scarcity, the disruption of the natural order, the disruption of the supply of agriculture, so that price fixing could be instituted as a mandatory policy in the United States. Far from a land of the free and home of the brave, far from the Charter of the Forest, far from the notion that the earth is bountiful, the Roosevelt administration put in place an act that said that the federal government's role was to impose scarcity on the earth. To impose scarcity on the earth. And out of that, you know, the self-evident nature of the anti-human lie that that represents is so pathologically clear. And Sasha, the tragedy I find is that we're sitting in 2020. And do you know how many people even know that that act was passed in 1933? I mean, you hear the Securities Act of 1933, you hear the Banking Act of 1933, you hear about the financial piece, but you don't hear about the most insidious and evil act, which says that we are now going to suppress the livelihood, not of ourselves, but we're going to suppress the livelihood of nature as an act of social order. And so Anna's petition to be more thoughtful and more introspective about the concept of what natural law is and what that whole principle is something that not only is timely, but the roots of the corruption are not a present challenge. They have been a persistent challenge, certainly since the narration of the Magna Carta in 1215. And I'm just honored to be on this conversation and be able to witness the great work that Anna has been doing. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you, David, for that. Anna, please comment anything you wish to there, and then I'm gonna pass on to Renée.
I'm very glad that he brought up the Charter of the Forest, because he's right. Hardly anybody knows about or talks about that. And we really should, because it's the foundation of land and soil law in the Western world. And land and soil law is what we need to invoke, because that's what is at least potentially understandable by the court system that we have now.
Correct.
I'm also glad he brought up the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which is actually infamous and terrible. But there's another aspect to that I wanted to bring forward, and that is that it's actually a doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church called the Doctrine of Scarcity. And and that's based on the idea that we're bad people and we need to be chastised. and that we need to be controlled, and that commodities need to be controlled and parceled out to us like rats in a maze with, you know, you only get one piece of corn for every right answer. It's outrageous that the church has had this kind of power and that it has abused it to such an extent. But that's the truth. And when they threw out the doctrine of discovery, it caused an incredible ripple effect across the world as people finally woke up and realized that having a man storm ashore with a flag and planting it on the beach and saying, "I claim this land in the name of King James or King Queen Isabella or whatever," was complete and utter horsehooey, and it meant nothing. Okay, so finally they gave up the doctrine of discovery, and I've been after them to give up the doctrine of scarcity too. Lord only knows what is going on in Pope Francis's brain at this point, because he has certainly taken no stands on anything of importance that I can see in the public for the last 3 years. But getting rid of this doctrine of scarcity would certainly be a step forward for the church and for ecclesiastical law in general. And we do have to deal with ecclesiastical law on top of everything else. People don't think about it, but some of the most deadly court actions involve ecclesiastical law, because they basically work their way through the chain. They go in steps. They go through municipal law. They go through territorial law. Then they go to their only remaining option, which is ecclesiastical law. And that's where so many people get creamed in the end of a legal action, because they don't realize that they're progressing through these steps from remedy to cure to ecclesiastical plea. And
thank you for that. And bringing it back to that, I'm going to bring the conversation back to canon law after we bring Renette in. I'm very keen to get your take on the correlation between doctrine of discovery and dum diversus in 1472, which was the subjugation of the Saracens and the pagans to essentially also under the thrall of the Catholic Church, because all of the attendant misery that's been married to humankind, you're quite right, seems to go back to those foundational nodes that were planted. I mean, I always refer to that as dream spell, because I think that that's what it was. I genuinely believe that it was Babylonian mysterium cult logic to casting those canons, those acts, those papal bulls. But Renette, sorry for keeping you to the side for so long. This is great to see you again. And same question to you that I put to David, which is please just your summary on the status quo since we last spoke.
Well, interestingly enough, the hammer may be coming down here in Nevada County, California. We're a small little town in Northern California and the Sierra Foothills. And we have our board of supervisors meeting today that basically is looking at code enforcers that can go out and start fining citizens for not wearing masks inside stores, businesses, or on the sidewalk. They're also looking at fining the actual businesses themselves for not abiding by the guidelines, though most vast majority of businesses are, so it seems a bit of an overstep. And the first offense will be a $1,000 fine, the second offense will be a $5,000 fine, the third offense will be a $10,000 fine. They're also looking at retracting business licenses, which I don't even know how that's legal, because that usually is the California State Board that does that. And they're also looking at revoking your driver's license if you don't do what they say. The other thing that's really quite interesting is that the Board of Supervisors, the county itself, I should say, has made it very clear to our little city of Nevada City and our neighboring city, Grass Valley, that if we do not accept their COVID money, because Nevada County received $10 million from the state, which I call hush money. And they've made it very clear to the two cities that if Nevada City, for instance, does not take the $120,000 and spend it on code enforcement, and it must be all spent by the end of December, which is a lot of money for code enforcing for a tiny town of 3,100, that our relationship, the city's relationship with the county, will become very difficult. These are the games they're playing, because we have actually, the cities have said, we don't want the money. We don't want to do code enforcement. And the county made it very clear that you're going to have to. So this Board of Supervisor decision is coming up today at 1:30 Pacific Standard Time to be decided upon. And I think that, you know, we hit upon this earlier, that people are starting to wake up, by the way. I do know that we had a Black Lives Matter protest yesterday in downtown Nevada City, and some American constitutionalists, I don't even know who they are actually, folks came in, and we actually had a clash on our Broad Street, Main Street. And I think it's disturbed a lot of people. So I think people are starting to kind of step back and look at this much more deeply, because they realize that this is not something we're seeing happen in Portland. This is not something we're seeing happening in you know, Oakland or New York City. It's happening in a little tiny town of 3,100. We had a clash yesterday. We had several clashes throughout this BLM protest. They're just peacefully going along, you know, throughout the streets. But it's made it very real, and we need to start asking these questions. And so the other thing I think it's very important to point out is we do know about the Rockefellers lockstep document from 2010. And I think that our community here in Nevada County needs to understand that we have to really start backing up and looking at what's going on in California. Our chair of the Board of Supervisors, her name is Heidi Hall. And what most people in our community do not know as that before Heidi Hall moved to California to be a kind of environmental progressive Democrat, she first worked for Goldman Sachs, then she worked for the Rothschilds Incorporated, then she worked for the Rockefeller Foundation, then she moved to California to be this progressive liberal. She is the one who is definitely pushing mandatory vaccinations on the whole entire county, as well as she's the one that proposed this draconian urgency ordinance upon the people of Nevada County, who by far and large have been abiding by the guidelines.
Thank you, Rainer. Well, let me just jump in there.
One of the things, when you look back, right, hindsight's 2020, it was last fall that the California legislature passed a bill that didn't seem that significant at the time. And that bill was giving unilateral decision to our public health directors of each county, that they could close businesses, shut people down, quarantine them, mask them. At the time, it did not seem significant. But now you look back and you realize, why did our state give that kind of unilateral power to a person who's not elected, not appointed? They're hired by the staff of the county to have that kind of power over the whole entire economy and the freedom of the people.
Very good. Well, I'm going to ask Anna to speak to that. And while she's doing that, Anna, do you see any possibility of Mr. Soros hoisting that colostomy bag over his shoulder and lurching off into the sunset? Or are those gremlins, those archetypes, going to always be operating from behind the curtain? Because clearly that's what's behind what's been going on in Nevada City.
I actually think it'd be very easy to handle George Soros, Bill Gates, any of them, simply by liquidating their corporations and confiscating their assets. I mean, if we did it to even one of them, they'd all scurry like cockroaches. And we could do it because we have the ability. It's just a matter of fact that they are, we have not been exercising our public interest as a legal community or as a lawful community, either one. And one of the things that I just have to say is that the general populace is not subject to code, it's not subject to statute, and it's not subject to regulation. They have to have a basis for their claims. And the basis of their claims is that you have voluntarily accepted citizenship conferred upon you without your knowledge or consent. And that you are now a municipal citizen, and therefore you're subject to code. Well, you have the ability to take against that and say, no, I'm sorry, I don't accept your conferred citizenship, and I don't need it because, you see, I'm an American and I have my state citizenship if I want it, or my state national citizen status if I want it, and you are my employee. Yeah, and that's what really has to come forward here. You're our employees. We are the employers. And we also have to take them to account for it. As I said, we can front public interest action and we can smack down these corporations. We can liquidate them. We allowed their charter. We can disallow their charter. They are acting in contravention of our rules and on our soil. So we do have the right to do that to them. And we should, in my opinion.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. Well, that for me is where the conversation is going to go, because what I'm looking to do, I mean, Raynette, you're a counselor. You pulled out as the mayor a few weeks ago, but you're a counselor.
Pulled out as city council as well.
Ah, okay. So you are now just a shit stirrer.
I am.
Well, that's terrific. Well, what we could do is speak and invite Judge Anna and Dr. David Martin to collude with you. You've clearly got a hell of a lot of respect and love from the people, and I'm sure a lot of people in the council as well. So perhaps that's something we could really look to do, to try to forge some real stratagem for remedy. Because if what Anna is saying is entirely correct, we all know it to be so. So why don't we just make a go of it? David, would you like to speak to this?
I think Anna's comment points to one of the reasons we find ourselves where we do. And I think it is a depth of illiteracy, which is by architecture, without question. I mean, the fact that we don't teach in any substantive way what the American experiment was. We don't teach in any substantive way what it means to be a person versus a citizen versus a municipal participant. There's a number of layers that we don't even engage. And so the incredulous nature with which people take on the fact that they are being controlled and manipulated is something that shouldn't come as a surprise. We have not taught anything other than the indoctrination of the oppressed for now hundreds of years, potentially longer. But certainly for hundreds of years, we've made no effort to teach people any of the nuance about how they're being manipulated and controlled, because the managed control of scarcity is in fact in the interest of a few. When anybody ever tells me that the system isn't working very well, I simply remind them that it's working perfectly for the people who designed it. It's amazing what happens when you have the ability to remove the bars from the cage and people still stay in the cage. So the fact is the system works very well. Mind control and brainwashing has been very effective for a long time, will continue to be. But the fact is that we're in a position now where the ability to actually take a stand, which says that the benefits afforded to us are actually not worth the costs that are being required of us. I think that's where we now find ourselves at a point where humans have to start making some decisions as humans, not as the kind of operators that they find themselves in. The number of people who have told me that my outspoken nature, not only historically, but what's about to be unveiled in what I say in a couple movies that are coming up very shortly, I've been advised how dangerous a position I put myself in. And I remind people that you cannot take from me that which I have never given. And I don't have the capacity to give. You can't take something that somehow is a quid pro quo when I haven't participated in the exchange. So you can't take something from me that I don't actually have to be given in the first place. And as a result, the ability to actually operate as a free agent and as a member of a community of humanity is something that I can consciously choose to do at any point in time. Yeah. I think that I really want to make sure that Anna's point is reinforced here. I think that we have been sold a bill of goods with respect to the benefit for going along with the game. Like somehow or another, we are benefiting from having passports. We're benefiting from having access to certain media. We're benefiting from having access to certain telecommunications infrastructure. And the fact of the matter is, it is not a beneficial exchange when one party willfully keeps another party in the dark. There is a principle called fraudulent inducement. It's actually one of the only legal principles that has the unique benefit of, if found to be the case, fraudulent inducement allows you to demand a reparation to the pre-induced state. Now, what does that mean in regular language? That means if I have violated something about you or your property or your interest, and I have done it under fraud, then my obligation is I have to restore the state to before I was in the picture at all. I actually have to remedy, not just compensate, but I have to remedy by reinstituting the pre-damaged state. And fraudulent inducement is something that is a critical piece of law, and it's been a persistent piece of law for actually thousands of years, that it is in fact illegal to misrepresent a condition as a benefit when you are extracting something that actually is not disclosed to the counterparty. So each one of these things is actually something that we have in our laws, and what we need to do is get communities of actors to actually take them seriously.
Very good. And David, thank you also for reminding us that, you know, about sole sovereignty and about the sole covenant. Because you're absolutely right. If there's no contract, off it, there's no contract, the end. And it does apply to how, to the extent to which one can be affected adversely in the temporal sense. There is, if there's no permission granted at the soul level, it's not going to happen, baby. That's just the way it is. But I love the fact that you keep coming back to that, because you're entirely right. Judge Anna, can I ask you, if you had one silver bullet to deploy, only one, and you had to take down the Leviathan. We know it's a Medusa, it's a multi-headed creature. But given only one silver bullet, what would you be taking aim at, in either institutionally or as an archetype, an individual, a seal, a throne in the world?
Boy, that's a toughie. One silver bullet. Because of the current state of affairs and the methods that they are employing to basically oppress people, I think that it would be the use of public interest action through the court system or through the legislature, either one, in which we take down the corporations, because what we're facing now is corporate feudalism. The monarchies and the papacy benefit greatly from those traditional monarchies, because the papacy gains from the monarchs, and the monarchs then go out and do the dirty work and collect all the tithes and send it back to Rome. And so they like that system. It benefits them. And with the end of colonialism, they were at loss. You know, how are we going to continue to have this vast income stream and continue to milk our cows, right? And so they've come up with this scheme to implement corporate feudalism, in which the monarch is replaced by a corporation, or corporations in our case. So the heart of the matter is, do people control corporations or do corporations control people? At some other point in time, it might be more important to ask other questions and use other kinds of silver bullets. But right now, making corporations accountable is job one, because they've been placed in the position of being monarchs over us, when in fact we are the ones that grant them the ability to exist.
Very good. Thank you for that. Raynette, any comments to what you've heard from David and or Anna, and then move on to explore a little bit more about how we can actually begin to forge some stratagem for remedy in Nevada City. We may as well take on a designate and go for it.
Right. No, basically I would say is we are very much a fast moving train. And I have to say, I'm greatly concerned with the most recent developments. In fact, I'll be interviewing my natural half brother. It took me 20 years to find him. He lives in Melbourne, Australia right now. And I'm doing a podcast with him this afternoon, because you know what's happening there is very much our future here in California. And Nevada County, to let you know, has been in the past the least vaccinated county in the state of California, possibly the whole United States. So I do know that we're quite targeted here. And however goes California, goes the rest of the world. So I do know that the people are waking up here. There's still those who are still in complete fear. The numbers are great as far as, you know, COVID positive cases, but the fear continues to grow in the state of California. And I think that we have to move quickly. So, and as I mentioned before, I'm no longer on the city council, and I did this by design because to be honest, I could not allow City Hall and the staff to be in the crosshairs. So I think that we need to move quickly, and I'd love to collaborate however we possibly could to bring this all to a quick end, because it
What is the Achilles heel? What is the Achilles heel right now in Nevada City as you see it?
Well, the Achilles heel right now is the overreach of government, right? And I have to say that we really do need to look at the Board of Supervisors, because they are the ones who are exacting and perpetrating this illegal government overreach upon the people. And so we really do need to look and focus on the Board of Supervisors, the county level. This is where it's all coming down. We just had the governor only about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, say, well, you know, I can't mandate any of these laws. You know, and yet he's been saying that for months, and it was a quiet little press conference he had at the end of it. He mentioned that, right? But what's happened is, in the minds of the people, they believe that yes, he can actually dictate those laws, and that he has that kind of power. And what he's done is he's defined this in such a way that he's given and developed this in such a way that he's given the county, or the county believes that they have the power to exact this type of draconian law upon the people. And so I think that we really need to focus on the Board of Supervisors specifically. And because these are crimes against humanity, and I did let them know that in my letter to them. So I just want to say to both David and Anna that I would love for us to work strategically to bring this to an end and let Nevada County, Nevada City be that actual template.
And how many supervisors are there on the board? And can you get the charter across to us?
Say that again.
I'm asking how many supervisors there are as living men and women, and secondly, are you able to get the charter across to us?
Yeah, I could do that. There's five of them all together, and yes, I can do that for you. The charter of the cities and the counties, yes.
Well, can I just ask Anna, just based on what you've heard here, what would a next step be in a situation like this?
I would hold them personally, commercially, and commercially responsible. I'd hold them liable. Make them accountable.
Very good. Very good.
It's simple.
Well, David? Remember, Sasha, that a bribe is a bribe, no matter how it's wrapped. And we seem to be forgetting a very important thing. These are corporations, right? Cities and towns and counties are in corporations. They are in corporations for a reason. They're in corporations because, to Anna's earlier point, this is a system which has actually been built to shield individuals from accountability. The tiny problem is, when you're shielded from accountability, that is as long as you stay within the mandates and the writs of what it is you actually are authorized to do. But shields of liability, and the Department of Justice has a beautiful opinion letter on this, so if you want to look at it from the DOJ's perspective or any other State Department of Justice perspective, the criminal liability ceases when the acts are outside the scope of the authorized actions taken by the community. So it doesn't matter that somebody has a fig leaf that says, well, I'm doing my acts as a agent of this corporation and I'm doing it shielded by corporate immunity. You are not shielded if the action you're taking is actually a violation of the law. And the notion that you are actually subjecting your citizens to things that are not even judicially authorized, and you're doing so for consideration. You are being paid to do an illegal act. That is a bribe. Let's call it what it is. And let's make sure that when you actually are taking a bribe, there is no corporate charter under any construction of anybody's laws. Whether we agree with the system or not, we have to understand that even under their own rules, under the broken system, that's a bribe. And it's called a foreign corrupt practice if you do it internationally. And it's a corrupt corporate practice if you do it domestically. And that corrupt practice is not shielded in any form of immunity. So individuals, actually, when they are committing crimes, are liable for their crimes, regardless of whether they think there's a corporate shield. These individuals who accept funds to enforce an illegal act are in fact committing a crime. The crime is bribery. The crime may be extortion if they actually demand a consideration.
They are.
These are things that ultimately become the basis of an argument. And my criticism of the conventional legal community over the past now 7 months is that they are debating the window shade colors for the incarcerated cells in which we find ourselves rather than questioning the jail in its first place. We are not in a position where it is appropriate to actually debate on whether a face mask ordinance is appropriate when a police power, which was illegal, is the predicate upon which that's built. We must go to the root of the tree. You cannot actually sit there and criticize the leaves and then wonder why the tree still flourishes. The fact of the matter is we have to go to the root. And the root, to Anna's point, the root to Renee's point, is that these are corporations. These are individuals engaged in illegal actions within corporations. And as such, they are personally culpable.
Very good.
Well, by today at 1:30, if they pass this ordinance, then they're going to be criminals and we need to pursue it. We're quite sure.
Very good. Very, very good. And I think that's the point. Anna, if there's a knock on your door and the local public health official waving all sorts of statutory bullshit in your face, pull out a syringe and lunge at you, how do you deal with that in real time, being forced to wear a mask and or roll up your sleeve?
I think they would find some pointed shotguns, 12 gauges. Ka-chunk.
That's unambiguous.
She does live in Alaska, I just want to say.
Well, okay. We know that these vaccine companies have no accountability. Zero. They've had no accountability since 1987 when they went to Congress and said, we're going to stop producing vaccines because we're getting so many tort claims. So many people are coming forward with damages. Which should have been a clue that maybe the things that they were doing were wrong if they were causing more harm than good with their vaccines, right? Maybe they should have been encouraged. Oh, by all means, go right out the door and stop producing these things until you know what you're doing. I mean, that's my answer. Okay.
Very good.
But anyway, they went to Congress and said, we're going to stop producing vaccines. So Congress said, oh, well, we can't have that. So we will absolve you of all accountability for your products or any kind of damage resulting from your products. And we, as the government, will lay it on the backs of the taxpayers and the victims so that the government becomes responsible for any tort claims that result from vaccinations. Well, that's all well and good. It's harder to sue the government, but at least you can still sue somebody for killing you or ruining your life or maiming you or paralyzing you or any one of the other nasty things that can result from vaccination. But then the government corporations go bankrupt. So now there's nobody holding the strings. There's nobody left accountable financially or materially for any kind of damage that these vaccinations cause. And it just so happens that you can't conduct business on that basis. So what in the hell are they doing? How can they even begin to pretend that they have any right to conduct business under those conditions? They don't. If you don't stand behind your product, if you're not accountable for your actions, then in our world, in our actual factual world, they don't have a right to conduct business.
Very good. Thank you. David, same question to you. I'm very keen to know if you get that knock on the door, because to most people, and certainly to 99% of people watching this broadcast, that's the question they're asking themselves. How do people like Judge Anna or Renette or Dr. Martin deal with the man at the door?
Well, I actually point out that if you do anything without consent, you're actually committing a crime. It is an assault and battery crime if you're an individual. And there is no question that the knock at the door, metaphorically or really, would involve a allegation, in my instance, of a criminal invasion and a criminal assault, for which I would actually contact law enforcement, because that's what it is. It is a criminal offense. It is a criminal offense under 21 CFR to actually be forced to participate in a clinical trial. That is something that the Nuremberg Code set out. That is something that every action that has been taken since then has set out. And the fact of the matter is, in this particular instance, we have no evidence, first of all, of the things that are precedent to giving rise to the need for vaccination. And we have no evidence that the vaccinations have been thoroughly vetted under their own standards. And there's all kinds of other precedent. Therefore, this is a clinical trial. Forced participation without consent is actually assault, and it's a criminal assault. And that is, in fact, how I handle those things. These are not things that have an abstraction. It's very clear. In fact, I find that energizing this fear of the, Alan Dershowitz plunge the needle in your arm, doctrine, right? Alan Dershowitz, among other things, has been associated with Jeff Epstein, has been associated with receiving massages, albeit wearing his underpants, which he's made very clear was the case. It was all with his underpants on. He's been associated with the kind of consummate picture of sex trafficking, abuse of women, and potential pedophilia. These are all things that are in his now morally justified space. If a person who is actually associated with a pedophile rapist tells me anything's being plunged into anything, I have a little moral compass that goes off in my head going, I'm probably not going to listen to him as a moral authority. The number of people who have given him airtime boggles my mind, because the fact of the matter is, if a rapist or a person who associates with rapists tells you they're going to plunge anything into anything, there's an outside chance that they're not worth listening to. There's a very simple way to deal with those kinds of threats, and those kinds of threats are best dealt with the way they should be dealt with. It's an assault. It is a physical assault and battery charge. And rather than taking anybody's advice, you call the cops and you say, there's a murderer at my door.
Very good.
That's what you do, because there is a murderer at your door.
Very good. Just to change tack slightly, because I'm required to bring a slight education component in here whilst we've got such good brains. Judge Anna, can you please just give some a little bit of background to the Civil War? What was the Civil War in America really all about?
Well, our first clue is that it's called the Civil War, which means that it was occurring at a certain jurisdiction that we don't normally think about. It was occurring among the government factions. The Civil War in America was not actually fought by the states. The Civil War in America was fought by the states of states, which are business organizations that provide services to the actual state and people. So when you look at the musters coming out of the Civil War, you see men were mustered out by the state of New York or the state of California or the state of, whatever. So it was the state of state organizations, business organizations that were funding this and that were fighting it. And the men that were signing up probably never even knew that they were engaged in a mercenary conflict. They weren't told, I'm sure, and so they went off to war thinking that they were fighting for their state, when in fact they were fighting for their state of state, and instead of acting as honorable soldiers, they were acting as mercenaries. And that has been the same status that they've been in ever since. And none of them have been told this, but that is the fact. Anyway, so the state of state organizations went head to head, and as we know, there was the North and the South. What we don't know is that they were all Confederate states. There was the Northern Confederation and the Southern Confederation, and the nature of the BC was that they were all mercenaries and they were all mercenary interests. They were all businesses slogging it out. And so the North and the South were essentially the same, two ends of the same entity that were at war with each other. under spurious circumstances. I mean, nobody knew what this was actually about or what kind of entity was actually fighting it. And in the middle of this, you have the British territorial government and the Papist municipal government siding respectively with the North and the South. So you had three, what you began with were three organizations, all of them were subcontractors of the actual states and people, called federal subcontractors of the actual states and people. The actual federal government and the actual federal constitution was broken at that point because of the Southern secession, right? So the North and the South ends of this organization split apart, the Confederation, and they took up arms against each other. Then the territorial government sided with the Northern members of the Confederation, and the Papist municipal government sided with the South, and they went at it. And we all know the results. After the war, the British territorial government was left in control, and the Papist municipal government was required to pay reparations. So they never settled their differences. They just kept a war going between the British territorial government collecting reparations and the Papist municipal government having to pay them. And in real terms, that meant that the 14th Amendment citizenry came into existence.
Well, thank you very much for that. Fantastic. Raynette, does that correspond with the history books that you grew up with?
Not at all.
We're almost to the top of the hour. So, Raynette, I'm going to ask you for your closing comments and then move on to David.
My closing comments right now is that we are at the ultimate crossroads, and I do believe that time is of the essence. I don't think we have months. I don't think we have another election cycle, to be honest. We have a matter of a few weeks, and we have to strike while the iron is hot. And I do have to say that the good news is that the draconian thumb is pressing down on us so hard right now that we are feeling the squeeze. It is becoming very real. And I think this is really where we can strike now, because the growing discontent is growing, you know, every day. So I'm excited about the conversation we've been having today, because I feel like we are actually identifying avenues towards solutions, because people are in a quandary. They're extraordinarily concerned. They are crying out for help, and they feel powerless at the moment. And what this conversation has completely told me, and I'm sure your viewers, is that we are empowered, we are sovereign beings, and we do have a God-given right to live freely.
Beautiful. Thank you, Renee. David.
You know, there have been many statements made over the centuries about what the price of liberty is. But what we know is that the cost of liberty is education, and education, not indoctrination. If we want to have a country, if we want to have a world in which we have a more human experience, then there is going to be a necessary element of that, which is it is incumbent on all of us to take the responsibility of educating people deeply. The fact that I can sit on this call and make reference to several documents, which are foundational documents in terms of the jurisprudence of humanity, the Charter of the Forest, the Treaty of Ghent, the nature of the British and the Dutch corporate structure, which shielded people from liability, but did not shield them from criminal acts. These are things that are available. And once they are available, then they also become things that become part of the normal conversation about solutions. The fact of the matter is, as Renette just said, there is an act that is soon to be taken in Nevada City in the county, which is actually an illegal act taken by individuals within a corporation that are not shielded from liability. But it is incumbent on the people to actually take action. And this is not something, and let's remember that whether it's the church, whether it's a monarchy, or whether it's a corporatocracy, when we cede our sovereignty to any third party, It is on us to take responsibility for our secession from our own sovereignty, and it is incumbent on us to reverse that. We cannot sit idly by and wait for the Renettas and the Annas and the Davids of the world to take action. If we ceded our accountability, if we ceded our sovereignty, it is incumbent on each one of us to take it back. And does that mean it's going to be without some form of reprisal? Absolutely not. Does it mean that we will not have access to certain agencies that are afforded because of this massive behemoth that we have? Certainly not. But that does not mean that it is up to someone else to do. I encouraged people in May of this past year to file Form 195, which is the Federal Tort Claims Act, which allows people to actually hold the Department of Health and Human Services accountable. Do you realize that I am now getting emails because DHS is responding? They are actually coming back to people and asking for evidence of damage. And what I'm getting from people is emails saying, now, Dave, how do I provide the evidence of what I alleged? Well, here's the newsflash. The newsflash is, this is your moment to gain your accountability for your allegations and your actions. If you've been harmed, you have the evidence. But we have a pattern that says it's somebody else's problem. Even the solution is someone else's problem. And the truth is that this is not someone else's problem. This is a problem of our creation, and it's incumbent on us to take back our sovereignty as humanity.
Beautiful. Thank you, David. That's beautiful. Judge Anna, I'm going to ask you to join us for another conversation on another broadcast at your convenience, so we can talk more about the paper balls at Discovery, and really keen to drill into the connection between seminal calendric nodes like the Council of Nicaea and the 1066 Doomsday, Papal Bulls of Discovery, and then Dum Diversus in 1472, leading on to where we're at as a civilization, clearly at the closing of the wheel of a civilization. But I think so many people are fascinated by the Babylonian Mysterium, a cult that appears to have been operating from behind the curtain for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to look at those date lines and those seminal nodes in the civilizational wheel, try to make sense of it in order for us to intellectually disentangle, in a sense, and be able to release ourselves from this trauma. Because at the end of the day, all of those things I'm speaking to were the imposition of diabolical event horizons, which embedded tremendous trauma into otherwise ineffable, majestic, spiritual beings. And it's really, that's the journey we're on now, is to shake off that Atlantean nonsense and take the journey wherever we steer it as a species, without pretending that any of us can prognosticate what that journey is to look like, for God's sake. You know, our capacity to love and be loved and our capacity to engage relationship is the only thing that truly matters. And that must become surely the source code of any new civilizational wheel. So Judge Anna, thank you for joining us. And I'd like to invite your final closing comments on this broadcast.
Well, I certainly want to thank you for inviting me. And I do want to talk to you about the New Earth Union, which is very much in line with what you were talking about throughout all of your work and writing. We are looking forward to the formation of a worldwide union of people that believe in individual right and natural law, and who assert this and bring it forward into the public forum. I did want to, just as a help to Renette, the reason that these county commissioners think that they have the right to apply such code, okay, to people is that they are asserting that everyone is a municipal citizen. And not everyone is a municipal citizen. In fact, the very basis of municipal citizenry has its roots in the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment was passed by a defunct Scottish commercial corporation. So it has absolutely no basis in law or any kind of authority anymore. I mean, when a commercial corporation goes bankrupt and dissolves, that's it. So the 14th Amendment that was passed as a part of their quote unquote constitution has no basis in reality anymore. And any kind of conferred citizenship based on this doesn't exist either. So the very first thing that I would tell the county commissioners is municipal citizenship doesn't exist. So whatever you are presuming is wrong. It just, you don't have the authority, I'm sorry. And you, I would be happy to talk to you on a private basis about all that. But anyway, if you're not a municipal citizen, if you're not part of the municipal corporation, you are not accountable for it in the same way that you're not accountable for wearing a Burger King uniform and showing up at 6 o'clock to flip burgers if you're not a Burger King employee. Okay, so what they're doing is absolutely stupid. It's, there's no grounding for it. In fact, it's all in their head that they think they have the authority to do this or tell anybody to do anything. And any public health concern is their concern as individuals. Fine, they can be as afraid as they want. They can go hide under their bed and, you know, put a big mask over their head and hope for the best. But they have no ability or right to tell anyone else to do that based on their position as county supervisors. The other thing I want to point out is that we have a Nevada Assembly well established. It's already been up and rolling for about a year now. And you can actually join the Nevada State.
We're in California.
Okay, well, you have it in California too. We're in all 50 states.
We have assemblies here in Nevada County.
We have assemblies all over the state. And you can join. And that then is a declaration, a clear statement of the fact that you're an American, not a municipal citizen, not bound by the papacy, not bound by any municipal code.
Nice. Thank you.
Thank you. That declaration is seminal. Thank you very much indeed. Judge Anna Von Wright, Dr. David Martin, Reynette Seenum, thank you so much. We're looking forward to the next one. And can I just ask you, David and Anna, I need to speak to you on a separate matter, a political matter, just for 2 minutes after this broadcast. So please stay on the line if you don't mind.
Certainly.
Thank you. Over to you.
I might have to put you in another line because this one is live streaming, but we'll make that connection happen. And I just want to thank you, Sasha, for being part of the inspiration and bringing all these conversations together and for speaking out about sovereignty for so long. So passionately, and there's so many people tuning into this conversation. I think as people are beginning to realize the scope and scale of what's going on, the illusion, right, the fantasy that we've all signed up and agreed to participate in, it's overwhelming, and people are getting a little kind of on overload. But I think these are the next step conversations where we're starting to give people the solutions now that they understand the problem. And these are the conversations that we want to facilitate because people needed to understand the problem. It's just like what you said earlier. We didn't realize that we gave up our freedoms. And so it had to get so intense and so to shake people up. And as you said, Sasha, it's kind of a soft landing, right? It could have been a lot more intense, but we know what's happening in South Africa. We hear people reaching out in Australia. We hear what's happening in states, my own state, our governor has lost his mind. California, we seem to, you know, be side by side. I mean, where what they're talking about. But I think when the people start stepping into their power and realizing that this is something that we are agreeing to, that and if we don't agree to it, if we don't consent and we're not willing and we don't participate, then we take back our power. So the work of all of you is just is inspiring people around this planet. And so I just want to thank all of you for the bravery. And Reynette, I am so excited to back you up. And like Sasha said, we are like, you're stepping out and we're going to support you full force. So that's what this network is, this new earth that we're birthing. So thank you all for your participation and your bravery, your courage and your fierceness and speaking that out. So we'll be tuning in for more. We do have, people are asking, we do have a Facebook Live on Friday with Sasha Stone and Charlie Freak, just because people are asking, and that is confirmed. We're bringing on the voices that are speaking out on Australia next week. David, you're going to be part of some of these conversations. We'd love to have you back. Anna, of course, and Renette, you as well. So thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you're not on our mailing list, reclaimyourlives.com, make sure you're on it so that we can all stay connected. And Sasha, I'll put you all in another message right after this. But thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Thank you very much.
Lots of love.